You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. We're going to talk about the release of Crystal Kizer from the Kenosha County Jail this week. The 19-year-old could face life in prison on charges of murdering her alleged sex trafficker. Her bond was paid for by a coalition of groups. Are you following this case? What is the outcome you're hoping for? Join in right now, 800-642-1234. But first, Wisconsin is home to many food traditions, and there are family stories behind every dish. Our colleagues at Wisconsin Life have crisscrossed the state looking for stories about recipes and the families who are reflecting on their culinary traditions passed down. WPR host Keely Baltina talked with Maureen McCollum, the host and producer of Wisconsin Life, and series producer Kelly Saran from PBS Wisconsin.
Kelly, let's start here. Why the focus on food?
Well, I think food is a good gateway to kind of be introduced into communities and to into people's homes that maybe we don't get a chance to kind of have that intimate look. And I think food's an easy in. Everybody eats on every day, and everybody kind of has their kind of food that they love and enjoy and they want to share. And it's a good way for us to share people's stories through food.
Stories through food make me think of the word traditions. Do you delve into different traditions around Wisconsin?
Yeah, we do. So the focus is food traditions. So the series is looking at how do people define food traditions for themselves. So we went out, we asked people to kind of welcome us into their homes and share a tradition with us. So what when I say the word tradition, what dish comes to mind? That's kind of what we asked for people. And we got a lot of different versions of that this project really kind of does an in-depth exploration of.
Is tradition more than just a recipe, or could it be just the ingredients and the final product?
Yeah, so we discovered that tradition means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Some people, tradition is in our piece, one of our pieces was actually grandmother's food. So it wasn't just a dish. It was really a culmination of dishes, or it was a way that you cook things, or it was a way you thought of things in the past. For others, it was a traditional dish. Maybe it was ingredients that they combined to celebrate traditional ingredients, but they made it kind of their own. So I think really it's fun to explore what tradition means for different people, and tradition can mean a lot of different things. So we really want our viewers to also think for themselves, what does tradition mean to you? And when you look through these stories, you can kind of find bits and pieces of, oh yeah, that tradition reminds me of this, and oh, I have a tradition just like this as well.
Maureen, what's your takeaway from learning about all the different ways other people interpret the word tradition?
Playing off of what Kelly said, it's really fun to see how different people, different families take similar dishes and just kind of have their own spin on it. So we have one story, a woman named Anne Marie Herman. She lives here in Madison. She presents one of her favorite dishes, which is salt fish cakes. Now, Anne Marie, she grew up on the island of St. Lucia in the Caribbean, and she talks about how these salt fish cakes are such a hot commodity. Anytime she goes to a party, it's like the first dish to go. And so WPR producer El Malik Anderson, they spent an afternoon in Anne Marie's kitchen and just learned about how she makes the salt fish cakes, why this dish means so much to her, why cooking in general means so much to her. She's published two different cookbooks. And, you know, for her, it's just a way to keep the memory of this place where she grew up, to keep that memory alive and people happy.
We just heard that story, and I'm curious, though, I mean, how many of your Wisconsin food stories involve fish in some way, shape, or how?
We could probably do a whole food tradition story on just fish in Wisconsin, to be totally honest. Like, I mean, there's, of course, the fish fry. We haven't really dove into fish fries for food traditions yet. Maybe next season, we'll see. But we do have another story in this food tradition series on smoked fish. So this story comes from WPR's Mary Kate McCoy, and she traveled to Prairie du Chien, which is along the Mississippi River in southwest Wisconsin, and she spent a day with Mike Valley. Mike Valley is a third generation fisherman, and he's one of the few remaining commercial fishermen on the upper Mississippi River. So Mary Kate hung out with Mike on his boat, which is like a dream assignment, let's be real. And then he showed her his like giant smokehouse where he smokes all his fish. Mike then goes and like he'll sell his smoked fish at his store in Prairie du Chien, which is called Valley Fish and Cheese. It's been around since the 1980s. And it's just really interesting just to hear about his passion for not only this fish and how much fish has meant to his life and his family's life, but how he takes that fish and smokes it. And in the story, you'll basically hear him say, like, it's to die for.
The photos do look to die for. And that's what's nice about this piece, too, is it's an audio and photo essay. So it's nice to kind of hear him out on the water, but then also get to see this amazing fish and kind of his setup and the beautiful views, as Maureen mentioned.
Yeah.
Well, that even underscores the question I was going to jump in with, which is, how hungry do you get when you're doing these stories?
Keely, I'm starving right now.
We've got Maureen McCollum here and also Kelly Saran. They're both producers at Wisconsin Public Media for Wisconsin Life. That means they are putting together stories for PBS Wisconsin, for Wisconsin Public Radio, and digital versions for wisconsinlife.org. And we're talking about a series on food traditions here on the Ideas Network. Kelly, we've got a story about Sasquatch. What is this?
Yeah, so Sasquatch is actually a dish that was created by Chef Elena Terry of the Ho-Chunk Nation. She lives in Wisconsin Dells, and she crafted this dish. It wasn't really a traditional dish for her, but she decided to craft it as a celebration of indigenous foodways and Wisconsin ingredients. So she took squash that she actually grows out in her garden, and those are kind of heirloom squash as well, so there's kind of that seed revitalization as well. She takes maple syrup, walnut crust, and then tops it off with tart cranberries on top, and she decided to call it Sasquatch, which was actually kind of a fun way to do it, and it was wonderful. It was so nourishing to kind of be in her home, and what I really loved about Chef Terry was that it's not just about kind of creating a dish and it's the end. It's about kind of respecting the ingredients as you create the dish. And she would talk about kind of meditating on the creators and the people who had grown these seeds in the past, and kind of meditating as she's cooking. And when you taste that dish, it's so like soul nourishing. It's really hard to describe. But that kind of the way that she crafted it really shows in the way she does. So for Elena, it wasn't so much about the dish itself. It's kind of the ingredients coming together to celebrate all the things that Wisconsin has to offer and her community has to offer.
And Kelly, what do you want people to take away when they check out this series?
Really, I want people to kind of look at the series. And within each story, I think our viewers will kind of find a little bit of something within themselves. So within Sasquatch, maybe the looking at the cranberries reminds you that you have a family cranberry recipe. And really, we are asking our viewers to kind of delve into this content, but then come back at us with their own food traditions. Share that with us. Take photos, take videos, share your traditions with us. We really want this to become a collection of traditions around the state. And how do people define that? We want to know. So contact us, follow us on our social media channels, and share your traditions with us.
Kelly, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.
And Maureen, thanks for sharing your experience.
Thanks for having me, Keely.
And that was host Keely Baltina talking with WPR's Wisconsin Life producer Maureen McCollum and PBS Wisconsin producer Kelly Saran about their food tradition series. You can find it at wisconsinlife.org/food traditions. Coming up, we look at the Crystal Kaiser case. The 19-year-old was freed from the Kenosha County Jail this week. She was incarcerated about 2 years ago after shooting and killing her alleged abuser. Are you following this case? What do you think of her being freed on bail? We're at 800-642-1234. We'll talk with a reporter covering the case. That's in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the Crystal Kaiser case. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The 19-year-old from Milwaukee charged with murdering her alleged sex trafficker was freed from the Kenosha County Jail this week after awaiting trial for nearly 2 years. A trial date has not been set yet. Are you watching the developments in this case? What outcome do you hope to see? We're at 800-642-1234. Jessica Contrera is a reporter with The Washington Post. Jessica, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, give us some framework here about who Crystal Kiser is and why are you following this case?
Yes, Crystal Kiser is a 19-year-old Black young woman. She is from Milwaukee, and in 2017, she met a 34-year-old white man, Randy Volar. Mr. Volar then became Crystal's sexual abuser. There's video evidence. Because Crystal was underage, she qualifies as a sex trafficking victim in the state of Wisconsin. Crystal went on to kill Randy Volar, and so now she's facing life in prison for that murder.
She was freed on bail this week, and groups have been calling for her release. What are you hearing?
Yes, there is great community support both within Wisconsin and around the world for Crystal. They see her as a victim of abuse who was trying to defend herself. The prosecution says that they see it another way. They believe that they have evidence that the murder was not in self-defense, that it was premeditated. So the last 2 years have been a lot of back and forth between both sides. But as more people learn about Crystal Kiser's case, the more support she has. There is a petition online with almost 100,000 signatures asking for prosecutor Michael Gravely to drop the charges against her.
What is her defense team here using to try to defend her? They're using something called affirmative defense law.
Yes. So Wisconsin, like many states, has a law on the books that's called the affirmative defense. What it says is that if you are a victim of trafficking, then crimes that you commit that are a, quote, direct result of the trafficking that you experience are something that you could show, you could argue in court, you know, I did this crime because I was in this particular situation. The question at hand is, well, which kind of crimes can you use that defense for? So Crystal's team reads the statute and says that she's clearly a victim of trafficking. She clearly did this as a direct result, and therefore she should have the opportunity to make that case in court. The prosecution says that that statute wouldn't apply to Crystal because the crime that she did was a violent crime and the most serious crime.
Has a defense like this been successful in the past?
That's a really great question. So in Wisconsin, since the affirmative defense law was on the books, it really hasn't been used very much. It's sort of something that lawyers might talk about behind closed doors when they're making plea deals, but it's not something that has been quite so tested in the court of law. And that's true really across the country. There are various versions of these laws floating around. So this case, what happens to Crystal, really could set a precedent for the rest of the country.
We're talking with Jessica Contrera. She's a reporter with The Washington Post, and we're taking a look at the Crystal Kiser case as Kiser was released on bail this week after nearly 2 years in jail after the alleged killing of 2018 of Randall Volar. I want to ask you, Volar was under investigation by the Kenosha Police Department for sexual misconduct after allegedly abusing multiple underage Black girls. And in February of 2018, he was arrested on several charges, including sexual assault. How has the Kiser defense team handled that?
That's a great question. You know, we're still almost in the early stages of things, so that could really play out more when she does go to trial. But what we know is that this is a man who police were well aware that he was doing, that he was committing crimes. What we know, though, is that that didn't mean that he was taken into custody and kept there. The same day that he was arrested, and that his house was raided, he was released. The police and prosecutors say that they were in the midst of investigating him, that they were getting ready to charge him when he died, and that they were trying to figure out, you know, exactly what crimes he committed based on the ages of the girls that he was abusing. Documents that we were able to obtain show that there were multiple girls, that the majority of them were young Black girls, and that some of them the police believed to be as young as 12.
How might this case affect other abuse survivors who are facing trial?
We are in a time of really a reckoning that kind of comes, you know, after Me Too, and also in this moment of everyone looking at racial injustice in the criminal justice system. We are seeing other cases like Crystal's where individuals who were, especially women, who were defending themselves are being looked at in a different way. Earlier this year, Alexis Martin, who was a sexual trafficking victim in Ohio, and she was a teenager at the time as well, she had already gone to prison for her involvement in a murder there of her trafficker, a murder that she did not commit. And there have been many people trying and trying to get her out of prison for quite some time. And recently, the governor of Ohio decided, as part of his efforts to reduce the prison population related to coronavirus, he released Alexis. So there are sort of a ball is rolling, and activists and advocates are really hoping that now is the time that individuals like Crystal are seen in a different way.
Going back to the Crystal Kizer case, what are the conditions of her bail?
So the conditions of her bail are, of course, that she, should not have any access to weapons, and that she cannot be in contact with certain people who she was in contact with at the time of the crime. I think that there are a lot of people hoping that this time, now that she's out of jail, will be a time of healing for her. She has been through, both sides agree, a significant amount of abuse at a very young age. And so she is, back in Milwaukee in a safe place, and people are hoping that this is the time where she gets the therapy and the support that she needs while she awaits trial.
You've been writing about what child sex trafficking can look like and some of the stereotypes that we have that may or may not be true. Do you have a sense of how common it is for abuse survivors to fight back against the people who are harming them?
That's a really wonderful question. And it's very hard to know, because for many years, you can go back through archives and find stories that look, strikingly like Crystal's, a young Black girl who kills or harms an older gentleman. And those cases were rarely identified as, those girls were victims of sexual trafficking. But that's beginning to change. And part of why that's changing is people are starting to understand what sex trafficking looks like in America. It is very rarely, a person kidnapped off the street whisked away in a car and tied up in a basement. The vast majority of child sex trafficking victims in the United States are tricked by people who they know, who they trust, who they believe love them, and have their best interests at heart. And so as parents, teachers, police officers begin to recognize that that's how sex trafficking happens, more and more is being done, hopefully, to stop it, and to stop situations like what happened to Crystal from ever occurring in the first place.
In Crystal's situation, how did Crystal Kizer and Volar meet? How did that happen?
That's a really important part of the story. So Crystal had recently moved to Milwaukee with her family, and they lived in a homeless shelter for some time. They were very much struggling financially, Crystal told me that she learned at school that some people showed her how to use a website called Backpage.com, and Backpage.com was basically a prostitution marketplace online, but it was shut down because there's so much child child trafficking on this website. This part of the story is especially important because people, might used to look at this and say, oh, well, you know, she put herself out there. But that's not a choice that a child can make. In the United States, when an adult takes advantage of a child, the crime is not with the child, it's with the adult. And so that's really been a really kind of central point in this case, because, you know, in this situation, this man was abusing girls who might not have considered themselves to be victims of trafficking.
Jessica, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Jessica Contrera is a reporter for The Washington Post. Coming up, nursing home residents have been devastated by the pandemic. Long-term care residents make up more than a third of coronavirus deaths in our country. We'll talk with the CEO of a Kakana home, and that is right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're checking in on how nursing homes are working to protect their residents and staff from COVID-19. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Long-term care facilities show the destruction of this pandemic crisis. In Wisconsin, dozens of nursing homes have reported 124 deaths to the federal government. That's data as of June 7th. And then there's the emotional toll, the families unable to visit their loved ones for 3 months and counting. Is your loved one in a senior living facility? How are they doing? What questions do you have for a nursing home CEO? We're at 800-642-1234. Sandra Norder is president of St. Paul Elder Services in Kakana. She's vice chair of public policy for the Leading Age Wisconsin Board of Directors. Sandra, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
Well, take us inside St. Paul, your facility, and how it has changed during COVID-19.
Well, as you mentioned, the biggest change for sure is the fact that we are not able to have visitors come and go freely as we would under normal circumstances. And that has no doubt been a heartache for our residents and their loved ones. But we have deployed all available resources to providing virtual visitation options, virtual engagement between our residents and their loved ones at this time. And we have been feverishly working to develop our guidelines and our protocols for the moment we get the green light from the Department of Health Services to start allowing for some limited visitation so that we can get, at least a couple of family members from each resident's family back in as quickly as possible, just to lay eyes on each other. We certainly know that isolation is a major social determinant of health. There is no doubt we are certainly seeing the effects of not engaging with family members amongst our residents. And we firmly believe that we need to find a balance. At this point, yes, this virus, we still have a lot to learn. But we do have a number of mitigation strategies and feel that we need to find a balance between, protecting the physical health in terms of infection control for our residents and preserving their psychosocial well-being at this point.
So both physical and mental health, there has to be a balance, I think, that is what you're saying.
Yes.
Sandra, give us a sense, how many residents and staff do you have?
So we have two campuses, one in Kakana and one in Green Bay. And in Kakana, we have about 320 residents. In Green Bay, we have about 60 residents. And total between the two campuses, we have about 450 staff members.
How are you doing with testing, and what does that look like?
Yeah, so Exact Sciences is a lab out of Madison, and they have been providing us with test kits to be able to do regular, what's referred to as point prevalence testing or sentinel surveillance testing, which just means that we are testing asymptomatic individuals on a regular basis. So for us at this point, we are testing on a weekly basis But we are in a rather unique situation because last week we emergently admitted 28 residents from another facility that had a major fire. So we have kind of a newly cohorted group of individuals. So that's specific to our organization. Most other facilities in Wisconsin right now are testing all their residents, all their staff, like every other week. So we basically order up the supplies from Exact Sciences. They send them up to us, and we set up a testing clinic. The very first time that we did it, we had the National Guard come and help us do it just because of the sheer number of people that we had. And, you know, just kind of wanting to see with the National Guard's experience with setting up, you know, big testing clinics like that, how they did it. And so we learned a lot from that experience and have been able to simulate that on our own since that time.
Have you had positive cases?
So we have. Back in early April, we had our first case, and that was at our facility in Green Bay. And that was at a time when the meatpacking facility in Green Bay was having the major outbreak, and there was quite a bit of community spread happening in Green Bay. So we did have one of our staff members acquire COVID-19 via community spread. She has since recovered, and there was no transmission in our facility from that employee. We also had an employee around the same time of our Kaukauna campus, but who also lived in the Green Bay area and acquired the virus via community spread. And she has since recovered as well. More recently, following our first point prevalence survey testing, we did identify one staff member who tested positive, who was pre-symptomatic at the time that they tested positive. She has since recovered significantly, is still out with some lingering symptoms. And around the same time, we had one resident test positive. She has since recovered also. And there has been no other transmission. We did testing of all staff last week, and all of those results came back negative. And this week we received all negative test results back from our residents.
And when you say point prevalence survey testing, what is that?
So basically it's where you test everybody,
okay.
Even everybody that's asymptomatic. So of course, if any of our staff or residents would ever show symptoms, we would test them individually. But point prevalence testing or sentinel surveillance testing is where you do your whole house, all staff, all residents as needed.
We're talking with Sandra Norder, Vice Chair of Public Policy for Leading Age Wisconsin Board of Directors. She's also CEO and President of St. Paul Elder Services in Kaukauna and a campus in Green Bay. With your questions about long-term care facilities and how they are working to protect residents during COVID-19, we're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sandra, how have you been able to handle personal protective equipment and being able to handle residents who you need to help feed and bathe?
So personal protective equipment has been a struggle for many facilities, particularly assisted living facilities that aren't necessarily accustomed to ordering all kinds of medical supplies. And, you know, a lot of the medical supply vendors have given priority ordering status to, you know, regular customers. And so assisted living facilities have really struggled, you know, particularly if they're a freestanding facility and don't have a relationship with a nursing home like we do. On our campus, we have a nursing home and assisted living. So we haven't had, you know, quite as much struggle with, you know, being given preference for ordering personal protective equipment. But you know, the thing that most of us continue to struggle with right now is disposable isolation gowns. They are just nowhere to be found. So most of us have had to resort to using cloth or washable gowns or some of these plastic gowns like what have been sent by the FEMA and the federal government. But yes, personal protective equipment is It's a big undertaking to don and doff personal protective equipment. So training our staff in the proper donning and doffing of that equipment was really critical. So we did quite a bit of training on that, produced a video for showing our staff how to properly, you know, put goggles on, put the gown on, and what order you do it, and how you dispose of it. And, you know, certainly there's a component that personal protective equipment is, you know, certainly makes our care a little less personal, a little more scary looking to our residents. So we've had to, you know, just really assure them of the reasons why we are, you know, have these shields over our faces and why we have masks on and you know, why they can never see our smiling faces. And, you know, it, for the most part, it has been, you know, just a matter of, you know, really good communication with residents, with families, with the staff. And, you know, but you mentioned, you know, what about, you know, during cares and during mealtimes, you know, at times when, you know, we can't maintain physical distance or we can't, you know, residents have their masks removed and, you know, are now have their mouth exposed. You know, it's just a matter of ensuring that our staff are masked and are wearing goggles or face shields at all times. For our residents, it's a matter of making sure that if they have to cough or sneeze, that we're encouraging them to put a tissue over their mouths or their faces or to turn away. You know, it's obviously not possible to physical distance during cares, but we're asking our residents to turn their faces away at times that we have to get very close to them. You know, so just taking every step possible to try to limit the amount of, you know, what it boils down to is the amount of air that we're breathing together.
Are the residents masked when they are in their rooms by themselves?
No. The guidance is that if a staff member is in the room with a resident, they should have their faces covered. Or if they leave their rooms, they should have their faces covered. But if they are alone in their rooms, they do not need to be wearing face coverings.
What has the cost of personal protective equipment, what kind of impact has that had on your bottom line?
We have spent $100,000 so far since the beginning of this pandemic on personal protective equipment and other directly related expenses to COVID-19. So, you know, for us, we're a nonprofit organization. Our yearly bottom line is maybe about $400,000. That's, you know, maybe a 2% profit margin. So $100,000 is a really big deal to us. So, you know, no doubt there has been incredible expense associated with this pandemic. And that's just in supplies. That's not even counting the increased labor costs that we've seen.
We're talking with the CEO of St. Paul Elder Services. Sandra Norder is our guy. Do you live in a senior care facility? What has the pandemic been like for you? How has your life changed? Do you work in a long-term care facility? How has your work changed amid the pandemic? Still time to talk at 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute with Sandra Norder right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On March 12th, 104 days ago, St. Paul Elder Services closed to all visitors and implemented a universal mask policy. We're checking in with its CEO, taking your questions and stories about an elderly loved one in the pandemic. Has a family member who lives in a nursing home contracted COVID-19? Has the nursing home your family lives in handled the pandemic well, in your opinion? What changes do you hope to see in the weeks and months ahead as the pandemic ebbs and flows? Still time to talk about this. 800-642-1234. We have Sandra Norder, who stays with us, and she's president and CEO of St. Paul Elder Services. Sandra, 104 days. I would imagine that the time goes by really quickly, but slowly all the same. What was it like to go from, you know, kind of a normal circumstances to just this universal mask policy and just quite a change in your services?
Yeah, it's been the challenge of our lifetime. There is no doubt about it. Fortunately, in skilled nursing facilities, we have always been required to have, really robust infection control and surveillance programs. And, a lot of our protocols and our tracking, our symptom monitoring, all of those protocols were in place because of things like influenza or norovirus. And so it was a matter of adapting them to this new novel virus and all that we have been learning about it. But the bones of our system was there, as well as our emergency preparedness plan. We have always been required to have a comprehensive emergency preparedness plan. Over recent years, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services really enhanced their requirements for emergency planning as a result of, things like the hurricanes in Florida and Texas that we saw over the last few years. And so we were required to do even tabletop planning for, broad emergencies. And in fact, last fall, we did at St. Paul Elder Services a pandemic tabletop exercise. Now, when we planned that, it was more along the lines of an influenza, something that we were familiar with. And so it didn't hit spot on, that preparation, but we certainly had, some sense of, what it would be like to activate our incident command structure, what we would need to consider in terms of, mass staff outages due to illness and how we were going to staff for our, numerous facilities. And, so it was something that we were prepared for in terms of our, overall infrastructure. The thing that we couldn't have ever prepared for was, turning all visitors away. That was something that we really had never considered as a possibility. Now, we certainly, regularly during flu season, we post signs and tell visitors that, if they're ill, to please refrain from visiting and those types of things. So we have never, physically locked our doors and said, people can't come in unless it's an end-of-life situation.
Well, let's bring in a call. Kathy is joining us from Beaver Dam. Hi, Kathy.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm just calling to inquire in regards to your testing. You had mentioned you had assisted living. I'm not sure if you meant an RCAC or a CDRF, but I'm just curious to know how you were able to set up testing for your assisted living and who covered the cost.
So we do, on both of our campuses, have both RCAC and CDRF. And for callers who may not be, or for listeners who may not be familiar with that, an RCAC is more towards like independent living. A CBRF is a little bit more towards like a nursing home level of care. And so it's just two different types of licensure of assisted living in Wisconsin. And assisted living has been a little bit harder to get the testing supplies and access to that testing. But for us, the reason that we were able to get testing access is because we had positive cases at both of our campuses in both of our assisted living facilities. So we were, really prioritized. At our Green Bay campus, that positive case happened at a time when, like I said, there was a meatpacking facility that was having a significant outbreak. And so the city and county public health departments had a unified command structure, and they basically took over the testing of our facility there. And then in Kaukauna, which is in Outagamie County, again, our local public health department has just prioritized our testing ability because we have been deemed in outbreak status. And public health, anytime there is a positive case in a long-term care facility, they consider the outbreak to be in effect for 28 days. That's two 14-day incubation periods. At this point, the state is covering the cost of testing. The program that they have set up through Exact Sciences, which is the lab out of Madison, that has been all covered by the state to this point. We don't have anything, in writing in terms of ongoing coverage of testing costs for the long term. But, you know, just in conversation and in direction from the Department of Health Services so far, we understand that the exact sciences testing will be covered for us at least every other week for the foreseeable future.
Kathy, thank you for the call. Let's bring in Bora now in Madison. Hi, Bora.
Hi, a longtime listener. I just wanted to make a comment. I don't currently have a relative in a nursing facility, but my father's dementia has progressed during the pandemic to the point where we need to place him in a facility. And the biggest problem that we have is there's really no way at most of the facilities that we've tried to see him or touch him or hug him. And it's really makes the decision much more difficult. So I was wondering, visitors in these nursing facilities, are they pretty much not allowed, or are there some facilities where they are allowed?
So right now in nursing homes, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services have directed the visitation restriction. And although the Centers for Medicare Services doesn't really have jurisdiction over assisted living facilities because they're not licensed federally, really the CDC has adopted that same guideline for assisted living facilities as has the Department of Health Services in Wisconsin. So the guidance remains that visitation should be restricted to long-term care facilities. The federal government and the state government has put out plans for reopening long-term care facilities that wouldn't have full reopening to visitation until a phase three. And we are really just kind of getting into phase one right now. However, we have pretty successfully lobbied, both the federal government and the state governments and encouraging them to take a look at how we can balance out, the need to preserve psychosocial health with infection control. And so, so far, 18 states have released guidelines for opening up to some limited visitation, and Wisconsin sounds like we're pretty close to getting some guidance. So, for us, we have plans and protocols set to go for as soon as we get that green light for doing some outdoor visits or some limited indoor visits. And when I say limited, I mean that, it'll be limited in time, probably 15 minutes or less. We're talking baby steps towards getting, visitors back in at some sort of normal rate. But even as we
see a spike in cases around the country, could that delay that news for you?
Yes, absolutely. So the overarching guidance is that we have to monitor the rate of illness in our community and the amount of community spread that's happening, and that we have to really lag behind the opening of the community. So if we were to see a large spike in cases in our community, we would have to pull back on that reopening plan.
Sandra, thank you for joining us, and take care.
You're very welcome. Yes.
Sandra Norder is Vice Chair of Public Policy for Leading Age Wisconsin's Board of Directors, and she's President and CEO of St. Paul Elder Services in Kaukauna and Green Bay. Just ahead, Planet Money's Patty Hirsch is here to talk about pandemic economics. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.